Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Did the Bush administration respond appropriately to the information it received about the threat of a massive attack in the weeks and months before 9/11 and to the newly evident dangers of terrorism revealed by the strikes on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon? Kurt Eichenwald is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and author of the new book 500 Days, Secrets and Lies in the Terror Wars, which closely examines the American response to the attacks in the 18 months after 9/11. He's also the author of a widely circulated op-ed published a week ago in the New York Times that details a number of explicitly worded memos from the CIA to the White House warning of an imminent al-Qaeda attack on a major U.S. target, memos that reached a fever pitch weeks before 9/11 but apparently triggered no specific additional security measures. Kurt Eichenwald will be signing books and then speaking Wednesday evening at an event sponsored by the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, and we are delighted to have him with us today. Kurt, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
So lots of people have known for some time about the August 6th memo, the famous one in 2001. The CIA sends this to the White House, and the heading is Bin Laden Determined to Strike in U.S. You have now read a lot of memos that have not been fully declassified, but that were given to the White House before that August 6th memo. Tell us about the content of those and why they sort of changed the interpretation of that memo.
Well, one of the things, you actually have to start with the August 6th memo to sort of get the whole story. In 2004, the 9/11 Commission was seeking to have the Bush administration declassify some of what are called the Presidential Daily Briefs, or PDBs. And they agreed to declassify this single one, the August 6th. And what they said was, you know, when it says Bin Laden determined to strike U.S., that, you know, that wasn't a prediction. It was more a description. And the whole August 6th briefing was a historical depiction of Bin Laden, which when you read it carefully, it in fact is. And what Condoleezza Rice, the former national security advisor, testified to was that if we'd had a warning, we would have done something. This is why what happened before August 6th was so important. And those presidential daily briefs were never declassified. They were never provided to the 9/11 Commission. And I got to see them. And they were quite revealing. There was one on May 1st of 2001 that said that there was an al-Qaeda cell in the United States planning an attack. There were ones in June that said the attack was imminent. There were ones that said there was going to be mass casualties, and it went on and on and on in that vein. And it was in late July that President Bush asked for a more historical and explanatory analysis of al-Qaeda, which is what resulted in the August 6th memo. But when you put the August 6th memo in that context, saying that it was a historical document is kind of dishonest. It was the culmination of months of warnings.
How did the how does the specificity of those warnings compare with the kind of information that was being given to the Clinton administration at the end of his term?
Well, the specificity has been one of the things that has been raised that's really been a canard. I mean, what people say is, well, you know, they said if we had been told when and where and how, obviously we would have stopped it. Intelligence doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. You know, if you walked in and said, Mr. President, when and where and how, and we arrested the guys yesterday. I mean, you don't have that kind of detail without having something, you know, a final action taken. The only thing that's comparable, according to the intelligence people I've spoken with, was in December of 1999. Was the previous time when there was a massive spike of intelligence saying attacks are coming. Those attacks were much more global in nature. They were going to be all over the place. And nobody had any specificity as to where and how and all the rest of that. And so what happened was the government went on high alert across the board. The FBI, the Justice Department, the CIA, the Counterterrorist Center at the CIA. In fact, the Counterterrorist Center was told don't worry about your budget. And they blew through 9 months of budget in 15 days. And that high alert resulted in takedowns of terrorist attacks, of planned terrorist attacks in Indonesia, in Pakistan, another country I'm suddenly not remembering. And there was a one in the United States where someone was planning to bomb Los Angeles International Airport. Now, people ask me if I'm saying, you know, 9/11 could have been stopped. I'm not. Because how would I know? Mm-hmm. What I am saying is there was a precedent. There was a precedent for how do you deal with this kind of high-level, massive intelligence saying something big is coming. You know, some people want to say, well, you get that all the time. No, you did not have this kind of high-level specificity and warning all the time. And again, it only compares to 99. So was there a failure? I think the failure was a failure to look back on precedent and say, what do we do in these circumstances? What have we done that worked?
It's poignant to think about members of the team in the CIA's counterterrorism unit who essentially were saying to each other, maybe we just have to get out of this because we're going to get blamed.
Yeah. I mean, there was a meeting on July 9th, 2001 at the Counterterrorist Center where the proposal was made. We should all put in for a transfer. Because this scene is depicted in 500 Days where they say this is going to be really big and really ugly and basically, we shouldn't be here. You know, we're the ones who are trying to stop it and no one will listen. And the fellow in charge of the meeting said, you know, there are not enough qualified people to take all of our places. We're the only ones with the qualifications to ride this thing down. And the thing that bothers me the most here, because I can't say, well, would 9/11 have been stopped or not? The thing that bothers me the most is that in the aftermath of 9/11, all the knives turned on the CIA and the White House pointing and saying we didn't have enough good intelligence and we didn't have this and we didn't have that. And people at the Counterterrorist Center, you know, got tossed out and there were all sorts of claims and things done, you know, to hold them accountable. And there was, in fact, there's somebody in the Counterterrorist Center who can't deal with 9/11 because every single year he knows that if people knew what he did for a living, they'd blame him. Even though he also knows that they did everything they could. And that's what I think is important about what's coming out from, you know, my reporting of what the presidential daily brief showed, is that if nothing else, it's demonstrating that this country has a lot to be proud of regarding the performance of the CIA, that the CIA did not drop the ball, that they gave the decision makers every scrap of information they needed to make a decision.
How did you get to see those briefs that have not yet been declassified?
Do you honestly think I'm going to answer that question?
I don't, but I figured that you have to tell me that you can't tell me.
I can't tell you.
Okay. talk about this. We will get to the obsession, if that's the right word. Maybe that's too strong a word, with Iraq. But tell us about what else the Bush administration was worried about at that point with regard to security. For example, China.
Pre-9/11?
Yeah.
One of the things to understand about the Bush administration, and this things always have to be looked at in context. The Republicans were out of the White House since 1992. When they left the White House, national security issues, as they had been throughout the entire existence of the United States, were about other countries, you know, Iran, Iraq, North Korea. And it was during the Clinton administration that this concept of transnational threats being the primary threat to the United States. By transnational, I mean, you know, not connected with any particular country. Just a floating group of people. When the Bush administration came in, you know, the GOP came back into the White House, they had spent their 8 years out of office, you know, banging the drum on Iraq. And when they came back in, you couldn't say Iraq wasn't a threat. You couldn't say that China didn't present national security issues. But they went back into form, that being other countries are the primary national security issue. And you really can't blame them for that because that was, you know, again, for out for the vast history of the United States, that was reality. And so in the summer of 2001, they were focusing on China, and there were issues there relating to a satellite and so on. They were focusing on North Korea. They were focusing on Iraq way too much, in my opinion. And in fact, one of the really shocking things to me in reading the presidential daily briefs was that there was a point in late June, the Pentagon started saying to the president that the CIA didn't know what it was talking about, that it was being fooled by bin Laden, that in fact bin Laden was working hand in glove with Saddam Hussein and was trying to distract the United States from Iraq by pretending there was going to be an attack.
Tell us why that's preposterous in your opinion.
It's preposterous in many different reasons. Number one, Saddam Hussein was a secular leader, and bin Laden was an Islamic fundamentalist. These are not two groups that go together. And what you had in that was, you also have to remember that in 1990, bin Laden declared war on Iraq. You know, and so the idea that they're working together is preposterous on so many different levels that, you know, just to make the argument, people in the CIA thought, we don't really have to address this, do we? It's so absurd. But they had to address it because the neoconservatives in the Pentagon, on the basis of no evidence, were advancing this, you know, Saddam and bin Laden worked together. And the same thing they advanced later during the buildup to the Iraq War.
But did they not have access, Kurt, during those 8 years they were out of the White House, to independent scholarship, academic work that had been done, looking at these groups and looking at the way that the threats in the world were changing?
But that's not what they were doing. You know, they were sticking with their knitting. They were sticking with what they knew.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to remember, you got to put al-Qaeda in context, that being in 92, it was nothing. Some people want to say, well, 93, that was the attack on the World Trade Center. That wasn't al-Qaeda. That was someone affiliated with al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda itself was in chaos at that point. Al-Qaeda really built up from 94, 98. It got its really big, you know, going on with the Cole was in 2000. The East African attacks on the embassies in 98. The Cole in 2000. Now, we didn't have final proof that al-Qaeda was behind the Cole until the second month of the Bush administration. But, you know, when you look at that, okay, let's talk about how much we've got. Two attacks, 50 Americans dead. And that's it. And then the Bush administration walks in and they're told the biggest threat to national security is al-Qaeda. For people to pretend that they recognized that and accepted it and realized and acted on it, it kind of stretches credulity. In a way, what I'm doing is saying the Bush administration can't really be blamed for not giving this the attention it deserved. They didn't know any better.
My guest is journalist Kurt Eichenwald. He's a contributing editor to Vanity Fair and author of the new book 500 Days, Secrets and Lies in the Terror Wars. You can be part of the conversation by calling in now to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Kurt Eichenwald. He's a contributing editor to Vanity Fair and author of the new book, 500 Days, Secrets and Lies in the Terror Wars. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I don't know if you even want to answer this one because it's kind of a mind-reading question, but we've all seen the famous videotape of the moment when President Bush was reading to the school children. Someone, an aide, comes and whispers something in his ear, and you see him sort of blanch. Do you think at that moment, I mean, have you thought about this? Did he think, oh, there it is. There is that thing that we've been talking about.
I would be surprised if he didn't make the connection, you know, and that moment, I actually should throw this in, that moment has been interpreted very badly because, you know, all anybody sees is Bush and this like, well, why did he sit there? And the reality is he had, for example, he had an aide right in front of him who already knew what had happened, who wrote a note and stood in front of the press and held it up and said, say nothing. Meanwhile, he knew they were establishing a secure room. There was nothing he could do. He couldn't talk to anybody unless they had basically a war room set up, and that was being set up in the classroom across the hall. And nobody wanted him there because there was nothing for him to do but to stand around. And once that room was set, Bush got up, went there, and took over. And so what looks like, you know, him sitting there empty-headed reading a book is in fact him doing what he should have done. You know, if he got up and ran out of the room, he just would have been in the way while all the equipment and necessary, I mean, down to bringing a television in and all the people in Washington were, you know, brought up on the phone. So, you know, that's the story behind that. But did he make the connection? I'm sure he did.
Do you think that the Bush administration deliberately promoted the fact that many Americans and frankly, many people in the media initially, at least, tended to conflate what happened on 9/11 with whatever conflict we had brewing with Iraq?
I think that there were efforts by certain members of the Bush administration to ignore reality. I think that there were people who were both true believers, that being there is no way that, you know, a bunch of, you know, disheveled guys sitting on top of a mountain in Afghanistan could have launched such an attack on the United States, which ran counter to all of the intelligence again. And I think that there were certain people who were wedded to the idea that only countries can do this. And so if you start by saying only countries can do this, well, you know, it's Iraq. But also there were people who were just dead. Paul Wolfowitz, number two at the Pentagon, was absolutely dead set on there being a war with Iraq. That's why when you go through, you know, the early history of the Bush administration, there's all this stuff about, you know, attacking Iraq. Dick Cheney was dead set on it. Now, did they believe there were weapons of mass destruction? I think so. The intelligence was terrible. But, you know, to the degree, I mean, if you think about it, you have the Pentagon saying when they're coming in with all this bin Laden information, well, that's ridiculous. It's really Iraq. You know, these are people who were true, were true believers. They weren't intelligence analysts, and when the intelligence analysts came in with material they didn't like, they ignored it and developed their own intelligence.
When you say true believers, that sort of causes me to leap to the conversation that the president reportedly had with Jacques Chirac of France. Tell us about that.
Well, that's a different form of true believer. This is a scene in 500 Days that has attracted a great deal of attention. This is coming at a point where Tony Blair, the Prime Minister of England, and Bush are trying to rally Europeans into joining in the coalition against Iraq. And Blair is assigned the job of bringing in Russia, and Bush is assigned the job of bringing in France. And he's failing. The President of France, Jacques Chirac, did not think the intelligence was any good, neither did Putin of Russia. that he thought it was very weak. And Bush came in, first pushed the intelligence, then said the UN has to be strong. If we project weakness, it'll damage the UN. It'll damage. I mean, he just kept taking different tacks of trying to persuade Chirac, and Chirac wasn't being persuaded. And at that point, Bush said, Jacques, you're a Catholic, I'm a Methodist, but we share a common faith, and biblical prophecies are being foretold, are being fulfilled. This confrontation is willed by God, and Gog and Magog are coming to, you know, reality. And Chirac was a little bit horrified as he was hearing this, and he got off the phone and asked people, what is this Gog and Magog? Do any of you know what he's talking about? And so the French government went and found an expert on the Bible in Switzerland and had him put together a report on what is Gog and Magog. And it ends up that it's something out of the book of Ezekiel and also out of the book of Revelation that relates to Armageddon. And when this came back to Chirac, that was it. He was no longer in any mood to discuss it. As he said, he's not going to send French troops into a war based on the American president's interpretation of the Bible. And so that was a rather deeply disturbing experience for Chirac.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We're speaking with Kurt Eichenwald, author of 500 Days, Secrets and Lies in the Terror Wars. Let's speak now on the phone with Jim in Dallas. Hi, Jim.
Thank you, dear. My question is, Richard Clark, who's written several books on the history of the Iraq war, said that when he was in Dallas, he was on the predecessor to the show, and speaking of the inability to gather accurate information by the CIA, he said that they never realized that Saddam Hussein was even going to go into Kuwait because the Iraqis didn't use phones to communicate. That seemed absurd to me, but then when he started talking about the way that they transferred information about the threat of Iraq to the Bush administration in its initial days, I wouldn't see where the administration would take them seriously after that kind of analysis. So I just wondered what your opinion of that was. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Well, what you're talking about is the 1990 incursion by Iraq into Kuwait. And there's no doubt that the United States government was really taken by surprise in that one. Not by surprise so much that they didn't understand the reason, or they didn't know that Saddam wanted Kuwait. It did have to do with access to the Persian Gulf. But simply that they didn't recognize that this attack was about to occur. And so, the quality of the intelligence back then was pretty dreadful. In the 8 years between 1990 and 1998, we had Americans in Iraq, we had weapons inspectors in Iraq, we had a lot of intelligence being developed, and we had a lot of context being developed. And so by 1998, when Saddam threw the weapons inspectors out of Iraq, we had already gotten pretty deeply ingrained into that country. And even though we didn't have official contact, we still had intelligence developing. And so the circumstances between 1990 and 2001 were very, very different in terms of intelligence.
Talk about how decisions were made early on about what would be done with detainees.
Well, a lot of it was done on a very rapid basis. People have to look back at this, and that's what 500 Days is about. It's trying to put people back in the context of what happened. It's written in narrative format, meaning, I don't tell you what's going to happen later. I'm just showing you events that take place in the time frame as they take place. And what you've got is a massive terrorist strike, a recognition globally that you're going to have to go after bin Laden and the Taliban in Afghanistan, a recognition of minor things. Well, you go into Afghanistan, you're going to be picking up a lot of people. Where do you put them? And once you have them, they're not, you know, they're not members of a country. That's the whole issue. What do you do with people who are not part of a country? And
but so the usual channels don't really work.
Usual channels don't work. And so they were trying to create on the fly some new means of dealing with all of this. And, you know, it's one of the things I try to make very clear in this book. This book is not a polemic and it's not a whitewash. There are things you will read that make Bush look dreadful. There are things you will read that will make Bush look smart. I don't tell people what to think, so I don't know which ones people will come away thinking that about.
It's funny. You've done a good job if you've made people angry on all sides.
Oh, that's the whole idea. And, you know, when you go through it and you look at the reality of the circumstances, you know, the White House wasn't trying to create a police state. And the people who were fighting for the rights of the suspected terrorists weren't trying to coddle our enemies. You know, we were really dealing with a very complex balance between national security and the rights of individuals. And, you know, throughout our history, there has been a tug and a push on those areas at times of war. And that's what was happening here. And there were discussions within the Bush White House about what's the right balance. And some people took it further than others. Some people made ridiculous analyses. And, you know, those ridiculous analyses were unfortunately sometimes carried the day. But, you know, for example, just to take one little thing about the concept of torture, and there was a development of the argument of intent. In other words, the argument was, if I beat you, but my intent is to get you to speak, not to hurt you, it's not torture. Well, by that standard, Syrians who pull someone's nails out, it's not torture. In fact, there's one scene in 500 Days where I'm trying to get people to understand what the standard is if you apply it to actual torture. And there's, you know, I describe what the decisions were, what the rules were that they developed, and then shift immediately to Egypt, where you've been over several scenes watching this man who plays a big role in some of the national security issues that develop. You've been watching this man be tortured. And I start to apply the rules and come to the point of the Egyptians could argue, based on the Bush rules, that this is not torture. And so, you know, those kind of decisions were ridiculous. There's my opinion. But other things, I mean, this is one that would upset the other side. Warrantless wiretapping, as it's called. Most people don't understand what it actually was. When you do understand what it actually was, it's kind of hard to say, well, that was a terrible decision. In truth, it was the right decision. Before I just spark the phone calls, let me explain why. People think that warrantless wiretapping means if you call your mom, Dick Cheney's listening in. And it's nothing like that. What they have, the NSA and the CIA had these lists of hundreds of phones overseas, what are called dirty numbers. These are numbers that have been linked to Al-Qaeda terrorists in the past. For example, there was in 1998, there was a phone call that went immediately after the embassy bombings to a phone in Yemen. That phone was deemed a dirty number, and the NSA began listening in. And in the course of listening into that one phone, they got enough information to stop several terrorist attacks. So that's the kind of thing that existed. But then when you had, let's say, the phone in Yemen, I don't know, it's one that did. If the phone in Yemen placed a call into the United States, we had to stop listening.
Right.
Because the rules were, once something crosses the American border, that's it. You're done. Well, now think about that for a second. The 9/11 hijackers were in the United States. And if they were getting any contact from numbers overseas, and they were, by the way, we could not know what was happening. And so the argument, and Bush actually said this publicly and people didn't get it, it's you have nothing to worry about if you're not talking to terrorists. And that really is what it came down to, you know, a call from outside the United States on a dirty number to someone in the United States or someone in the United States to a dirty number outside the United States. Now, at that point, the FBI takes over. There is a thing of hot pursuit. In other words, if a call goes to that number and that person immediately makes a call to another, you're allowed to keep following it. But you're allowed to do that under the law. You just have to provide an after-the-fact affidavit for a warrant. And so, you know, it is not as if warrants vanished. It's just in certain circumstances where it was unfeasible to use them. And the rules prevented you from listening in. That's what was changed.
Has that warrantless wiretapping been a really good source of credible information?
Extremely good source. There's a reason why it's still around. The Obama administration has not pulled the plug on warrantless wiretapping.
Or any of the other additional presidential powers, am I correct?
Well, the other presidential, no. I mean, they haven't gone around and said, okay, you know, that ruling is wrong. On the other hand, before the Bush administration left office, the head of the Office of Legal Counsel in the Justice Department did withdraw the legal opinions I was talking about as being ridiculous. And so even there, they were pushed aside.
Kurt Eichenwald is with us. He's a contributing editor to Vanity Fair and author of the new book, 500 Days, Secrets and Lies in the Terror Wars. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Kurt Eichenwald. He's a contributing editor to Vanity Fair and author of the new book, 500 Days, Secrets and Lies in the Terror Wars. Our number is 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we hear from Irma in Plano. Hi, Irma.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Mr. Eichenwald, I understand that hindsight's 2020, and Bush administration did not believe the CIA warnings, and so preventing 9/11 would have worked in hindsight. But once they went to war with Iraq and all the evidence mounted that Iraq had nothing to do with it, why can we not, I don't know who, the Hague, Desmond Tutu, not pursue criminal charges against Cheney and Rice and Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz, et cetera, for continuing a war against a country that had nothing to do with the, you know, the murders of 9/11?
Well, the biggest reason is that there was UN authorization. I mean, you had what was UN Resolution 1441 back in 1990, which was the settlement of the Iraq war then, and Iraq agreed as part of the ceasefire to allow for weapons inspectors. The big mistake Saddam made was he threw the weapons inspectors out in 98. And there was a reasonable thought that he was doing that because he had something to hide. What he had to hide, in fact, was that he didn't have anything left. Because if he was not a popular man, and he was not popular with the Iranians, and he was not popular with the Syrians. And he had been completely defanged. And if it got too public that he was defanged, he would have been in an enormous amount of personal trouble. And certainly the United States was going to be happy with that. And so by throwing the weapons inspectors out, he created this image that he had something that he didn't. Now, again, the intelligence didn't back it up. But the UN then in 2002 adopted a second resolution, which basically was, you know, you must comply now. Now, you know, once you have those coming down the path, there is a very strong argument that there is now a legal basis for a war. The fact that the war, I'm not going to excuse what happened. I mean, the intelligence was a disaster. No, the intelligence that was chosen to present was a disaster. There was great intelligence; it just was ignored. And so, you know, when you end up in a circumstance where people make horrific decisions, but based on authorizations from the United Nations and also an authorization from Congress, it's hard to say it's a crime. Now, there are others who've raised other questions about the use of waterboarding, the use of, you know, detention without trial, and these as being human rights issues. And there have been people who said that there should be prosecutions for that. That is a little bit more of a dicey issue, because it's not quite so. You can't sit there and say, well, the UN authorized it. In fact, the UN criticized it. So.
We have an email here from Kel in Dallas who asks, how does the CIA's correct prediction of the 9/11 attacks jibe with their director's assurance of WMDs in Iraq as a slam dunk?
Well, the slam dunk story, that's from Bob Woodward, and George Tenet, who was the CIA director, said that's not what happened. But one of the things that occurred here was you have two different groups within the CIA. The Counterterrorist Center, which was dealing with bin Laden, and then an entirely separate organization that was dealing with Iraq. You had the intelligence being, once the actual Iraq group was cut out of the intelligence development, and there was an organization of not too good at intelligence people running out of the Defense Department, some running out of the Pentagon, some out of the Vice President's office, who became basically their own mini CIA. And that's where intelligence was being developed. And basically, at the end of the day, Tenet was wrong. And the intelligence had been manipulated. But it was manipulated, you know, I'm going to give people the benefit of the doubt. It was manipulated because they truly believed that the weapons were there. And, you know, there were scraps of information that could be used, but they were lousy scraps. And you know, in the end, if someone came in just with a fresh eye and said, you know, what does the evidence really show, they would not have concluded that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And there's a reason why the French said there weren't. There's a reason why the Russians said there weren't. There's a reason why senior people in the British government said there weren't. Now, Tony Blair did believe they were, and he firmly believed there were. Bill Clinton believed there were. And so it's a tough thing to say, well, you know, they went in knowing it was fake. I don't think they did. On the other hand, I think their strategy was horrible, because now let's take a step back and think about it for a minute. Let's say there are weapons of mass destruction and Saddam does have control over them. I have an idea. Let's attack him. You know, I mean, that was the one thing even back then that I was scratching my head. It's like, well, if he has them, won't he use them? And fortunately, he didn't have them. And unfortunately, that meant the war was for no reason.
It's hard to believe, Kurt, that at this point our memories about this have grown somewhat fuzzy, but we were also very concerned immediately after 9/11 about biological attacks, and anthrax in particular, and you have some really interesting reporting in the book about that.
Well, one of the things to bear in mind about the anthrax attacks is Bush had been briefed even before he was president about al-Qaeda's attempt to pursue biological weapons, specifically anthrax and smallpox. And in fact, al-Qaeda did have a fellow by the name of Sufat who was running their anthrax program. And so when the anthrax attacks came in October, when there was all of this intelligence that there was going to be a second wave of attacks, and al-Qaeda had, in fact, planned a second wave of attacks, and suddenly there are anthrax attacks going on, Bush reached the very expected conclusion that this was al-Qaeda. And it really, amped him up. And from what I've been told, the anthrax attacks had a much stronger impact on him than the 9/11 attacks. Because, with 9/11, they were using our weapons against us. They as horrible as it was, the guys stole our airplanes and crashed them. If the anthrax attacks were al-Qaeda, that means this is their weapon.
That we don't have.
Well, that we have, but we don't use because it's, immoral. And we don't have sufficient stockpiles of the proper antibiotic to fight this. Mm-hmm. And also, there's an incubation period. So when you start with, here's an anthrax attack, this person died of anthrax, you have no idea how far this is going to go. And so, there's a good reason why people got reasonably scared. Now, in the end, there's been some controversy about whether the person identified by the FBI, a fellow by the name of Bruce Ivins, who was an anthrax researcher working for the military, there's been some controversy about whether he did it. And I got very, very deeply into the evidence. I've seen a lot of material. And I have no doubt in my mind that Bruce Ivins was the anthrax killer.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Adam in Fort Worth. Hi, Adam.
Hi, Chris. What's your show?
Thank you.
All right. I had a question about Richard Clark. I remember he had he had claimed that Bush had called him into the Oval Office and said, I want you to come up with a report that says Iraq did this. He resigned. He wrote a book about it. The Bush administration went after him pretty hard. I was just wondering if maybe you could maybe some insights on maybe their what motivated that.
Let me actually adjust the story a little bit. What happened was immediately after 9/11, there was a meeting in the Situation Room. At the end of it, Bush took Clark aside, and Clark had been the White House terrorism czar forever, even though at that point he had been moved off that job for a month or so. And he took Clark aside and said, I want you to look at the intelligence again and tell me if there's any connection here to Iraq. And, this is the same thing they've been hearing all summer. And Clark said, Mr. President, we've looked at this. There is no connection. And Bush said, I want you to look at it again. Now, what happened in the immediate aftermath was something that, the Bush administration tended to do, and it was really, really horrible. That being, when Clark came out and told this story, they went after him tooth and nail. They called him a liar. They called him, he's just trying to sell books. And he was telling the truth. That's what happened. And what a very, very simple response could have been, rather than tearing up a man who served his country so well, a very simple response could have been, we had evidence, we had intelligence suggesting that Iraq may have been involved. So, of course, we asked Mr. Clark to look over it again. That's it. That's what happened. And, it's a sign of I think one of the worst things about the Bush administration was that if you were somebody who came up with information they didn't like, they attacked. And the result of that is twofold. One, people aren't going to tell you information that you don't like if they think they're going to lose their career and reputation over it. And two, it was very easy to ignore things that were contrary to what you believed. And that is how you end up with things such as going into Iraq looking for weapons of mass destruction that don't exist. You know, you have to be – if you're in an executive position, if you are in the president or part of the president's administration, you need to welcome information, not attack. And, you know, it's just been the nature of what they did. And it was an enormous disservice to the president. And it was I don't know that he oversaw this. It seemed much more like a Karl Rove kind of approach. But, you know, it was a horrible way of handling things.
Is it too simplistic to say we underreacted before 9/11 and overreacted after?
Yes, because the underreaction, absolutely. The overreaction, you know, we were in a dark hallway where we couldn't see, and there was somebody in the room with a gun. And we didn't know where they were, and we didn't know who they were, and we didn't know what kind of weapon they had.
Or how many.
Or how many there were, or if they were about to shoot. And so the reaction you had from the White House, I mean, you know, was we're not going to let this happen again. And that's one of the reasons why the book, why 500 Days is written the way it was, because I'm trying to get people to remember what was it like when these decisions were being made? You know, how were things driving when these decisions were being made? I have avoided being too graphic with 9/11. In fact, pretty much, you know, you don't see the events that happen. But I do go into the Bali attack that took place. The nightclub attacks in 2002. And, you know, people who've read, it's a brutal depiction. It is, because it's sort of, I want people to remember, this is terrorism. This is what it's like. This is the problem. And what was really troublesome about the Bali attack, I mean, the scene immediately before the you start to see the attack unfold has Tony Blair meeting with Vladimir Putin in Russia.
Got about 15 seconds here.
Oh, okay. And Putin saying, you know, do you think that Iraq is a bigger threat than Islamic terrorism? And Blair said, no. But afterwards, everyone's saying, ah, this shows us why we need to attack Iraq, which was absurd.
Kurt Eichenwald is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and author of 500 Days, Secrets and Lies in the Terror Wars. He'll be speaking Wednesday evening after a book signing at the sponsored by the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. Kurt, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Happy to do it.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can find out about upcoming programs and download the free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.